Hello, welcome to Wiki World Order with Morgan Lesko. Highlights all the way down, from turtles all the way down, vaccine science and myth. A book from 2022. For complicated narratives and debates, I hunger for the strongest arguments and evidence on all sides. Fortunately, I was gifted this impressive book from 2022 titled, quote, Turtles All the Way Down, Vaccine, Science, and Myth, end quote. This post contains some of the book's most potent claims, framings, summaries, and questions on vaccine subtopics. In the information age, asking the right questions is critical, and this book includes questions that people can ask their doctor. Asking most of these questions to a doctor during your regular visit might incite an adverse reaction. These questions might not be safe nor effective for your personal pediatric situation. But I have copied these questions, and I encourage vaccine proponents and skeptics alike to search for and share the answers that you find. I am not giving medical advice. This is also not legal advice nor financial advice. Do you support using governments to pressure your neighbors into taking vaccines? Then please steel man some of this book's key questions, and be sure to share the answers with references. There are many footnotes printed within this book, but its hundreds of references can be downloaded online here. In the book's foreword, Mary Holland, J.D., President and General Counsel at Children's Health Defense, CHD, writes that this book, quote, was first published in Israel in early 2019. Later that year, a mainstream medical journal published a positive review of it. To the dismay of the Israeli medical establishment, the senior academics found the book to be well-written, serious, scientific, and important, offering a comprehensive view of the issue, end quote, from page 18. Quote, one academic, Daniel Mishori, PhD, a senior facility member specializing in ethics and philosophy at the Department of Environmental Science at Tel Aviv University, was so disturbed by the lack of discussion in the book of the book's arguments that he offered a cash prize, $4,000 donated to the hospital ward of choice, to anyone who could refute them. Since Turtles is over 500 pages and contains more than 1,200 references, Mishori declared that he would settle for a proper rebuttal to the harsh conclusions drawn in the first chapter of the book. To this day, no one has been able to meet his Turtles challenge, end quote, from page 19. Quote, another good reason the authors chose anonymity, and perhaps the more important one from your perspective as a reader, is to immunize the book against ad hominem attacks, a favorite tactic employed by the pharmaceutical industry and the medical establishment. However, this shoot-the-messenger tactic only works if there is someone to shoot. End quote from page 20. Leaving forward, we start part one on vaccine safety, and chapter one is titled Vaccine Clinical Trials. Chapter one is 50 pages with 70 references. The first chapter explains basic definitions and processes for randomized controlled trials, RCTs. It then breaks down key flaws and distortions to the term placebo. This entire chapter is freely available online, and I would strongly encourage everyone to read it. Page 54, quote, giving the control group an active substance in an RCT intended to test safety would be a bad design decision then. Yet this is exactly how new Phase 3 trials are performed. Instead of a placebo, the control group receives a different vaccine, which is certain to cause its own adverse events and can be in no way deemed a neutral substance. This deliberate distortion of the placebo concept in clinical trials of new vaccines is so prevalent that researchers and vaccine package inserts frequently refer to the bioactive compound given to a control group as placebo, even when it's clearly another vaccine or a similar bioactive compound, which in itself is not safety neutral. Falsely using the term placebo allows researchers to conclude that the new compound, quote, was proven safe, end quote, even though the substance the control group received was decidedly not a placebo. No logical explanation can be found for the ubiquitous practice of administering bioactive compounds to control groups in trials of new vaccines other than a desire to conceal the true rate of adverse effects of the vaccine. End quote. Discussing a case study of the diphtheria tetanus acellular pertussis DTaP vaccines by GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, and Sanofi Pasteur, page 57, quote, to summarize, the safety of GSK's 5-in-1 and 4-in-1 vaccines was tested against the triple vaccine, DTaP, which was tested against the older generation vaccine, DTP, whose safety was never tested in an RCT with a placebo control group. A turtle standing on the back of a turtle standing on the back of yet another turtle all the way down. Dapticel, Sanofi's triple Tdap vaccine, underwent 4 clinical trials during its licensing process. All of the trials were randomized and controlled, and in all of them, the control group received different combinations of DTaP or DTP vaccines, sometimes concurrently with other vaccines as well. Since the rates for the new generation vaccine DTaP groups were similar to that of the old generation vaccine DTP groups, the new vaccines received the green light. The bottom line is that none of the many products in either of the DTaP vaccine family lines routinely administered in the U.S. has been tested for safety in a clinical trial with a placebo-controlled group. End quote. This book goes on to describe the safety turtles belonging to vaccines on the childhood vaccine schedule of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. On page 72, quote, Childhood Vaccine Clinical Trials, a summary. The table below summarizes the safety testing performed in phase 3 clinical trials for the vaccines included in the CDC recommended childhood vaccination program. Table 1, the control group in phase 3 clinical trials of CDC's routine childhood vaccines. This table goes through diseases with their corresponding vaccines and each vaccine's control group phase 3 clinical trial summary. So starting with the disease, the collection of diseases, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, with and without polio, hepatitis B, and HIV, the first vaccine on their table is Pediarix. And here the control groups in the trials received either the Infanrix vaccine along with hepatitis B, HIV, and polio vaccines or other unspecified vaccines. No control group received a placebo. The next vaccine on their table is Kinrix, and they summarize that in the only trial specifically described in the package insert, the control group received the Infanrix and polio vaccines. The package insert doesn't mention any trial involving a placebo control group. The next vaccine is Infanrix, which is summarized as tested against a control group that received the DTP vaccine or no control group. The next vaccine is the DTP vaccine, which is summarized, the vaccine was developed in the 1930s and has never been tested in an RCT against a control group receiving a real placebo. The next vaccine on their list is Pentacell, and they summarize that the control groups in 3 of the 4 trials received an assortment of different vaccines. And the fourth trial's control group may have received no vaccines. However, its safety data is not presented in the package insert. The next vaccine is Quadricell, and they summarize that the control group in the trial received the Dapticell and polio vaccines. And finally, we have the vaccine called Dapticell, and they summarize that the control groups in the trials received other vaccines. So that's all the vaccines they list in the table for diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. The next disease on their table is Haemophilus influenzae type B. And the first vaccine related to that one is the Hibrix. And they summarized that the only blinded RCT had 2 control groups receiving another HIV vaccine or a DTaP polio HIV along with several other vaccines. The next vaccine on their list is Actib, where control groups received either the DTP vaccine or other combination DTaP-based vaccines. And finally, for HIV, they have PEDVAX HIB, where they summarized that most of the control group subjects received DTP or OPV vaccines along with a placebo whose ingredients were not specified. The next disease in Table 1 is polio, and it's the only vaccine for it here is IPOL, summarized as, this package insert does not mention any RCT performed for the vaccine. Next we have pneumococcal disease, and the first vaccine is Prevnar 13, which they summarize as being tested against a control group receiving Prevnar, the older generation vaccine. And next they discuss the vaccine Prevnar, which they summarize being tested against a control group that received an experimental meningococcal vaccine. The next vaccine in the table is hepatitis B, and its first vaccine is Engerix. And it summarizes that its side effect rate was compared to that of a previous generation product, the plasma vaccine. The next vaccine is Twinrix. This was tested in clinical trials against a control group that received separate hepatitis A and B vaccines. And then the last Hep B vaccine is Recombivax HB. And it summarizes that the package insert does not mention any safety RCT performed in infants. The next disease on the list is hepatitis A, and its first vaccine in the table is Harvix. And they summarize the control group in the main trial received the Hep B vaccine. In three other trials, the control group received several other vaccines, MMR, varicella vaccine, and more. The next vaccine is Vacta. In one trial, there was no control group. According to another document, the control group received a compound that included aluminum and thimerosal. And in the second trial, the vaccine was given concurrently with other vaccines and without a control group. The next collections of diseases we have is measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, which is chickenpox. The first vaccine is Proquad. And they summarized that the safety was tested in several randomized controlled trials, most of which were not blinded. None of the trials contained a control group receiving only a placebo. And the vaccine before that was MMR2, which was tested in 8 small unblinded clinical trials. All of the trials had one or more control groups receiving either the predecessor MMR vaccine, a measles rubella MR vaccine, or a single dose of the rubella vaccine. The next vaccine in the table is MMR, and that was tested in several small to medium unblinded and partially randomized trials. The control groups totaled about 1/10 the number of subjects in the trial groups and received no injection. The last vaccine in this section is Varivax, which is just for varicella chickenpox. In one RCT, the placebo given to the control group was actually the test vaccine from which the viral component was removed. Another trial compared two different formulations of the vaccine. And the last disease we have in the table is rotavirus, and the first vaccine there is Rotatec. And the control group in the trial probably received the vaccine sans antigen compound. The description of the control compound was intentionally deleted from FDA licensing documents. And finally, the last vaccine in the table is Rotarix. The control group in the trial received the vaccine sans antigen compound. All right, that finishes Table 1 of Chapter 1 of Turtles All the Way Down. Jumping down to page 78, quote, the claim made in this chapter is not that vaccines in general are never tested against placebo in their pre-licensure process. Rather, it is childhood vaccines recommended by the CDC that were never tested against a placebo, end quote. Jumping down to page 81, quote, in short, the vast majority of physicians and researchers are completely unaware of the manner in which vaccine safety trials are designed and conducted, and the methodological flaws inherent in that process. Summary. Vaccines, as opposed to other drugs, are given to healthy babies, and thus must meet a particularly high safety standard. Clinical trials of new vaccines must be impeccably designed and performed, thereby providing high-quality, reliable data about the product's efficacy and, more importantly, about their safety. Anything less is socially and morally unacceptable. As we have seen in this chapter, vaccine trials are designed and performed in such a way to ensure that the true extent of adverse events is hidden from the public. There is not a single vaccine in the U.S. routine childhood vaccination program whose true rate of adverse events is known. Current vaccine clinical trials methodology completely invalidates the claims that vaccines are safe and that they are thoroughly and rigorously tested, end quote. And finally, on page 83, quote, ask your doctor, was the vaccine that you are recommending tested in a pre-licensure clinical trial with a real placebo control group? If not, how do you, or anyone else for that matter, calculate its true rate of adverse events? Is it morally acceptable to conduct a clinical trial in infants for a new vaccine where the control group receives an untested compound, i.e., the vaccine sans antigen, which is likely to cause irreversible side effects and has no potential benefit? End quote. So a reminder, this potent first chapter is all available online for free. Please download it and read it. So next, we'll go into some debunking attempts. What about Gardasil? After finishing the Turtles book, I searched for rebuttals and debunkings. I found one criticism by Dr. Frank Hahn that the authors didn't bring up the HPV vaccine, which is part of the childhood schedule. He claims that its package insert says that it was tested against a placebo. Indeed, the book's first chapter only includes a footnote on HPV, so perhaps this is a valid criticism. While discussing the rotavirus vaccine trials, the chapter 1 footnote on page 71 says, quote, a similar, though not identical, design was employed in the pre-licensure trials of the human papillomavirus HPV vaccine Gardasil, end quote. The book describes the rotavirus clinical trials over 3 pages in the chapter and summarizes it in the table above. The Gardasil insert says, quote, 6.1, clinical trials experience. In 7 clinical trials, 5 amorphous aluminum hydroxyphosphate sulfate, AAHS, controlled, and 1 saline placebo controlled, and 1 uncontrolled. 18,083 individuals were administered Gardasil or AAHS control or saline placebo on the day of enrollment, and approximately 2 and 6 months thereafter, and safety was evaluated using vaccination report cards, VRC-aided surveillance, for 14 days after each injection, end quote. That's page 4 of the Gardasil package insert. So only 1 of 7 trials was controlled with a saline placebo. I looked at the injection site adverse reaction tables, tables 3 and 4, to see how many participants got all 3 doses. 7,644 got Gardasil, 5,094 got the AAHS control, and only 559 got the saline placebo. I don't yet have the expertise to know how professionals might describe the statistical power of their 1 saline placebo trial. But to me, this safety control group in the hundreds is far too small to then jump to hundreds of millions of doses. The injection site adverse events data tables do show many more adverse events in the AAHS control arm than the saline placebo arm, but these reactions are generally not severe or life-threatening. The next data tables cover systemic adverse reactions and systemic autoimmune disorders. But here, the authors merge the AAHS control with the saline placebo, hiding any more serious safety signals. There's almost no other data provided on how Gardasil or the AAHS control compares to the saline placebo. So it seems that the Gardasil trials did include 1 saline placebo control arm, but it was almost 1/10 the size of the vaccine sans antigen arms, and Gardasil did not share the most relevant safety data for the placebo arm separately. Dr. Hahn also cites the Gardasil 9 package insert as a counterexample for the book's claims. It does say that they ran 1 trial with a saline placebo looking for adverse events within 14 days, but this side trial only included girls and women aged 12 to 26, quote, who had previously been vaccinated with 3 doses of Gardasil, end quote. The raw data table also does show increases in most adverse events for Gardasil 9 compared to the saline placebo, and in the systemic autoimmune disorders section, they lumped together historical clinical trials of the saline placebo with the old Gardasil and the AAHS control. So once again, potentially useful saline placebo data was not included in the package insert. So at worst, maybe the book's claim should be revised to something like, quote, childhood vaccines recommended by the CDC were never tested against placebo with published safety data, end quote. The Turtles book does not cover COVID-19 vaccines, which are unique in their technology and Trump's Operation Warp Speed. I did not detect any significant blows landed in Dr. Hahn's other four articles either. He tended to confirm the book's key claims while using lots of COVID-19 examples, other strawman arguments, and groupthink rhetoric. Most of his counterarguments were also prophylactically refuted in the book. Another debunking attempt, polio and Hep B vaccines. In my searches for rebuttals and debunkings of this book, I found one more attempt by a legal academic, Professor Dorit Rubenstein-Rice. She claims polio is a counterexample and that, quote, the authors completely ignored the large placebo-based trials conducted for the Salk vaccine, whose formula is still the one used in the United States in the 1950s. Not sure about that, but reading through the study and evaluation of the 1954 poliomyelitis vaccine trials, a summary report by Francis T. et al., 1955, quote, one half would receive the vaccine, the other matching half, serving as strict controls, would receive a solution of similar appearance, which should have no influence on immunity to poliomyelitis, end quote. I had trouble concluding what that placebo was, other than, quote, consisting of harmless culture media, end quote. The book doesn't go deep into polio in Chapter 1, saving its complex history for Chapter 10. In Chapter 1 summary table, the book just cites the iPoll package insert. This package insert does not include the word placebo. The short warning section there says, quote, systemic adverse reactions reported in infants receiving IPV concomitantly at separate sites or combined with DTP have been similar to those associated with administration of DTP alone, end quote. And it cites footnote 11, but that footnote 11 refers the reader to, quote, unpublished data available from Sanofi Pasteur SA, end quote. Professor Rice then discusses the hepatitis B vaccine, claiming that, quote, as with HIV vaccines and polio vaccines, the book discussion here does not start with the first vaccine. The first hepatitis B vaccine was a Merck vaccine, a plasma vaccine in 1981. This plasma vaccine was tested against a placebo. The second hepatitis B vaccine by Merck was licensed in 1986. This vaccine was licensed in 1989. Her link for the 1981 plasma vaccine says, quote, the vaccine and placebo were packaged in visually indistinguishable 1 milliliter vials. One dose of the vaccine contained 40 picograms of HBsAg protein subtype AD in an alum adjuvant. The placebo consisted of the alum alone in the vaccine diluent, end quote. This is not an inert placebo, confirming the book's claims. The full 1986 package insert only mentions placebo in footnote 6, which cites, quote, efficacy of hepatitis B immune globulin for prevention and perinatal transmission of the hepatitis B virus carrier state. Final report of a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, end quote. And this referenced article does not describe the placebo used. The 1989 package insert also does not mention placebo at all. So thus far, I'm not seeing solid counter-evidence for the book's claims that polio and Hep B vaccine trials did not test against an inert placebo. Debunking attempts that I found often centered around the idea that saline placebos would be unethical. Before his first Gardasil critique, Dr. Hahn also referenced a broader article on placebo trial ethics by Dr. David Gorski. Most of Dr. Gorski's arguments explain, rationalize, and defend the current and industry standards. He explains their ethical framework and clinical equipoise. The establishment claims that clinical trials are unethical if they withhold standard of care treatments already in use. Many examples used to explain clinical equipoise involve treatments for patients who already have life-threatening medical conditions. But an unvaccinated infant does not inherently have a life-threatening medical condition. Turtles describes almost all of the diseases in the childhood vaccine schedule as having moderate to mild severity in Chapter 9. So the diseases that infants might contract later have low probabilities of life-threatening complications. This is a dramatically different starting point than patients who are already on their deathbed. Furthermore, quote, clinical equipoise is defined as the genuine uncertainty within the scientific and medical community as to which of two interventions is clinically superior. Friedman, 1987b, end quote. But the industry ignores, deplatforms, or excommunicates experts who cast doubt on vaccine safety science. Thus, the establishment orthodoxy denies any genuine uncertainty and self-validate their ethical framework. But what if this scientific process were fair and transparent? Then there would be plenty of genuine uncertainty to ethically justify pre-licensure clinical vaccine trials against real placebos. The Turtles book describes the option of three-arm clinical trials. Page 45, quote, in order to determine the true rate of adverse events of a new generation vaccine, a three-arm trial must be conducted, combining the two methods described above. In this kind of trial, subjects would be randomly allocated into three groups, one trial and two controls. The trial group would receive the new generation vaccine, the first control group would receive the current vaccine, and the second control group would receive an inert placebo. This trial design is considered to be of excellent quality, as it measures both the absolute rate of adverse events comparing the new vaccine to the placebo, and the relative rate comparing the new vaccine to the current vaccine, end quote. And the Turtles book also briefly responds to the establishment claim that, quote, it is unethical not to give the control group another vaccine, end quote. On page 76, quote, in fact, the opposite is true. It is unethical not to conduct at least one trial from which one can reliably estimate the rate of adverse events before a vaccine is licensed and widely used. As reviewed in this chapter, medical ethic guidelines permit the administration of a placebo to a control group in a clinical trial of a completely new vaccine and to a control group in a three-arm trial of a next-generation vaccine, end quote. Dr. Gorski writes, quote, I will instead argue that a much better way of looking at a placebo control is that it should be inert with respect to the outcomes being studied in the RCT, end quote. So, to most accurately calculate efficacy, this perspective requires an immunologically inert placebo that could not impact the disease in question. If the industry and regulators share the safety concerns of millions of parents, then placebos might be biologically inert. Such safety-focused placebos would be closer to the CDC's definition for a placebo as, quote, a substance or treatment that has no effect on living beings, end quote. But phase 3 trials are supposed to study safety, efficacy, and dosing. And Dr. Gorski defends placebo selections for efficacy-based outcomes instead of safety-based outcomes. So logically, this is an admission that phase 3 vaccine trials are not designed to test for safety. In total, as I read it, Dr. Gorski's article does nothing to refute the claims in the Turtles book. If placebos cannot be designed to test for both efficacy and safety, then large-scale efficacy and safety trials must need to be split up. This could simply look like the three-arm trials that the Turtles book suggests, and I agree that the safety arm of the trial should not be one-tenth the size of the other arms. The safety arm must also be scaled to identify rare adverse events before a vaccine is given to hundreds of millions of people. The establishment also discusses personal equipoise, but they seem to ignore the obvious option of letting parents opt into the risks of a real placebo trial with full informed consent of all the current knowns and unknowns of each disease and each vaccine. Surely that must be ethical and legal, but they never mention this possibility. Health authorities have been so panicked about the increasing millions of vaccine-hesitant parents that they conduct studies on communicating vaccine safety. Therefore, there are likely plenty of candidates willing to provide informed consent to real placebo trials. Contrary to most scientific paradigms, and with great hubris, vaccine evangelists seem to believe that their paradigm will still be standing tall a century or two from now. They also seem to have similar certainty in their medical ethics paradigm. They seem astonished that anyone would question the dogma, hold informed but contradictory opinions, or perceive different ethical priorities. This book was published by anonymous authors, but it's still interesting how each of these debunking articles still try to shoot the messenger, the classic ad hominem logical fallacy. Reading through counterarguments for Chapter 1, the facts seem generally agreed to, but the interpretations and ethical rationale diverge greatly. There is a giant gap between how industry-supported scientists and physicians evaluate the certainty of safety data compared to those who are industry-silenced. The establishment ethics rely on the assumption of safety, an echo chamber, and circular logic. They claim the existing vaccines have already been proven safe and effective beyond genuine uncertainty, and this validates their ethical paradigm that designs vaccines' clinical trials. But informed and skeptical scientists and parents are challenging the certainty of existing safety science. Skeptics have been complaining that there is inadequate data to prove a net benefit. Based on these different conclusions from the vaccine safety data, skeptics disagree with the industry's ethical paradigm. We demand more safety-focused placebo data, orders of magnitude more. All right, let's move to Chapter 2, The Science of Vaccine Adverse Events, A Missing Link in an Empty Toolbox. This one is 20 pages with 34 references. The previous chapter reviewed the pre-licensure process for childhood vaccines. Then Chapter 2 focuses on post-licensure safety reporting and studies. On page 90, quote, part of the American National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, IOM, is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization that serves as an advisory body to the nation on medical and health issues. Its role is to provide objective and reliable information and advice to policymakers, the medical profession, and the public. In 2011, in response to a request submitted by the U.S. Department of Health in 2009, the IOM was asked to convene an expert committee to review the epidemiological, clinical, and biological evidence regarding adverse health events associated with specific vaccines covered by the vaccine program, and to state its opinion on the evidence bearing on causality and the evidence regarding the biological mechanisms that underlie specific theories for how a specific vaccine is related to a specific event. It took the committee 2 full years of demanding work to complete the report, during which it carried out a thorough investigation into the available evidence, including epidemiological, statistical, clinical, medical studies in humans, and biological, animal and in vitro studies. The committee's conclusion was that there were only a handful of adverse events of specific vaccines for which a causal link between the event and the vaccine had been established. Of the 158 adverse event and vaccine combinations examined by the committee, a causal link was confirmed for only 14 of them and suggested for 4 others. The evidence favors acceptance. Almost half, 6 of the 14, were labeled anaphylaxis, an acute, immediate, and often life-threatening allergic reaction, which the committee associated with 6 different vaccines. The link between vaccination and outcome was virtually irrefutable for 12 of the 14 adverse events that the committee confirmed were causally linked to vaccination, end quote. Jump down page 94, quote, so the majority of the scientific literature regarding disease mechanisms consisted of superficial case studies, and the committee determined that only a handful of papers met the criteria of basic scientific research, studies that looked for causal links between vaccines and medical conditions through in-depth investigation of biological mechanisms. It is no wonder, then, that the committee could not confirm or deny a causal link to vaccination for over 85% of the adverse events examined. The shortage of applicable scientific research on adverse events, documented in its own report, should have prompted the IOM committee to sound a long and loud alarm. Yet instead of sounding the warranted alarm, the committee chose to give the all clear. The report's conclusions don't convey any sense of urgency, nor does the report call for health authorities to take any immediate action. While the report does not state it explicitly, news articles following the report's publication conveyed the committee chairperson's implicit message that all is fine. Only a handful of adverse events have been proven to be linked with vaccines, and even those are mild and rare. The IOM committee members know that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, but went ahead and acquitted vaccines anyway, based on a lack of evidence argument, end quote. When researching these types of tough topics, I find it critical to review official reports like the IOM 2011. It is probably worth reading through more if you're curious. Jumping to page 104, quote, ask your doctor, if our child experienced a health problem following vaccination, what medical tests are at your disposal to decide whether the condition was actually caused by the vaccine? We fear that our child could be adversely affected by a particular vaccine. What medical tests can you perform in order to determine whether or not she is at high risk of being injured by that vaccine? End quote. And let's move to Chapter 3, Deficient by Design, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting Systems. This is 22 pages with 50 references. Reading from page 107, quote, vaccine adverse event reporting systems around the world have similar modes of operation and functionality. Therefore, we will focus on the world's leading system, the U.S. Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, commonly referred to as VAERS. The VAERS system, jointly managed by the CDC and FDA, was established under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986 and began operation in 1990. Quote. Jumping to page 117, quote, while VAERS, with its grossly underreported, incomplete, non-randomized, and uncontrolled data, cannot contribute meaningfully to vaccine safety, it is ideal for those who might wish to obscure any links between vaccines and adverse events, end quote. And page 119, quote, this suggests that VAERS and similar systems were intentionally designed to serve as window dressing, that is, to provide a mere semblance of vaccine safety monitoring rather than the real thing. In practice, these reporting systems constitute another link in a chain, which began in clinical trials aimed at preventing the truth about the alarming rate of vaccine adverse events from gaining public attention. End quote. Now, in addition to VAERS, there is also the Vaccine Safety Data Link, VSD system. Reading from page 123, quote, the VSD system is not an adverse event reporting system and is therefore not covered in this chapter. It is a CDC-run information network that pools data from several major U.S. healthcare providers' computerized records. These providers have agreed to make available their clients' data to CDC researchers for the purpose of vaccine adverse event analysis and monitoring, as well as some other uses. The CDC's Vaccine Safety Office manages the VSD system. It is inaccessible to outside researchers, healthcare professionals, and the general public. Researchers who wish to analyze VSD data must submit a formal request to the CDC detailing their research proposal and intentions. Only CDC-approved researchers gain access to the system, end quote. And on page 126, quote, ask your doctor, are you familiar with the VAERS system? Have you ever filed a case with VAERS? If your patient experiences an adverse health event following vaccination, do you check VAERS for reports of similar symptoms before deciding how to proceed with the case? Do you report it to VAERS? Do you think healthcare professionals should be required by law to report adverse health events following vaccination, similar to their obligation to report cases of notifiable infectious diseases? End quote. Dr. Hahn provided a helpful correction or clarification in his third debunking article, claiming that, quote, under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, NCVIA, healthcare providers are required by law to report to VAERS any adverse event listed in the VAERS table of reportable events following vaccination that occur within the specified time period after vaccinations, and an adverse event listed by the vaccine manufacturer as a contraindication to further doses of the vaccine, end quote. Factoring in Dr. Hahn's criticism, perhaps the book should instead ask if doctors support expanding the range of adverse events they must report by law. Chapter 4, Epidemiology 101, This is 20 pages with 29 references. The fourth chapter is a helpful little one for anyone who is newer to these rabbit holes. It quickly explains the different types of studies with their pros and cons. Reading from page 144, quote, epidemiological studies come in several varieties. In an interventional study, a trial, subjects are asked by researchers to take specific actions, e.g. take a drug. While in an observational studies, researchers only gather information about the subjects. A prospective study tracks a group of people for a specific period of time and collects relevant data about them. A retrospective study analyzes existing data. Despite the fact that formal techniques and statistical tools are used in epidemiological research, there are no fixed recipes to follow when designing studies. Researchers must carefully select the research method, collect complete and reliable data, neutralize any bias, and apply correct analytical methods. Producing high-quality, meaningful research is no simple matter. Some even consider it an art form, end quote. Chapter 5, Purposely Biased Science, Epidemiology and Vaccine Safety, 54 pages, 114 references. And reading from the summary on page 198, quote, summary, epidemiological studies are the tool of choice for health authorities and pharma companies to maintain a facade of vaccine safety science. They are cheap, relatively simple to conduct, and above all, their results are easily manipulated. The five studies reviewed in this chapter illustrate some of the many methods researchers use to manipulate the results of epidemiological studies. And here's their list. Using unsubstantiated data. Using irrelevant data. Hiding the real source of data. Omitting essential data from the paper. Reversing the trend of raw data by means of undisclosed statistical adjustments. Using arbitrary, meaningless, and scientifically baseless calculations. Dismissing inconvenient findings on a speculative or arbitrary pretext. Misrepresenting the subject of the study to the public. Using a grossly inadequate research method. Using a research method that facilitates easy manipulation. Failing to address post-publication misconduct allegations. And overstating the significance of study results. All of them. Amazingly enough, this assortment of faults did not prevent any of these studies from being published in leading medical journals or lead to their retraction. No mainstream scientist, academic, or journalist has directed a single critical word towards the studies or their authors. The studies' scientific reputations remain unblemished to this day, and they are frequently cited in the medical literature and publications of health authorities as evidence of vaccine safety. None of those citing the studies ever mentioned their obvious flaws or the researchers' conflicts of interest, end quote. And on page 199, quote, ask your doctor, do you know who funds most vaccine science research? Are you familiar with the process used to allocate medical research grants? Would you expect pharmaceutical companies and government agencies to fund vaccine safety studies that could potentially find serious faults in the vaccines they manufacture, license, and recommend to the public? Are you aware that studies published in leading medical journals, which ostensibly confirm the safety of vaccines, suffer from serious methodological flaws and are fraught with authors' conflicts of interest? End quote. FYI, in Dr. Hahn's Turtles Debunking article number 5, he tried to take down the book's claim that the Madsen 2002 study, quote, actually shows a 45% higher risk of autism in MMR-vaccinated children compared to the non-MMR-vaccinated, end quote. Turtles, page 166. Dr. Hahn does not provide a link to the actual study, but his screenshot also suffices. Dr. Hahn chides that, quote, if the editors want to be seen as having any credibility at all analyzing studies, they shouldn't be making such a simple mistake. The only pair of numbers up top that differ by 45% are 53 and 77, which are numbers that delineate the number of children diagnosed with autism versus the number of children with other autism spectrum disorders. Both were in the unvaccinated group, end quote. Since I am asking similar questions as the book's authors, it took me one try in 1 minute to reproduce another 45% number derived from the raw data. First, I calculated the two rates of autistic disorder being compared. Autistic disorder rate in unvaccinated children was 53 out of 482,000, which equals 0.0001098. And then the autistic disorder rate in vaccinated children was 263 out of 1.6 million, which turned out to be 0.0001596. Second, I calculate the percentage increase of the vaccinated rate over the unvaccinated rate. Rate in vaccinated children minus the rate in unvaccinated children, all divided by the rate in unvaccinated children. And that equals 0.4528, which is 45%. The Turtles book's claim is correct that the raw data shows a 45% higher risk. Through the more subjective art of statistical analysis, this signal was buried. Dr. Hahn's simple mistake is an example of failing to entertain skeptics' questions with curiosity and humility. As usual, you can't find what you don't look for. Clicking through links in Dr. Hahn's piece, I did appreciate reading through one review article in Nature titled Emerging Concepts in the Science of Vaccine Adjuvants. I think this article provides interesting context and depth for those interested. The introduction mentions that, quote, despite their widespread use, the molecular mechanisms by which the available adjuvants, including alum, MF59, and the adjuvant system's AS0 adjuvants, actually work in humans is not well understood, end quote. Moving along to chapter 6, the studies that will never be done. This one was 40 pages with 73 references. This chapter covers the important subtopic of the lack of safety testing of the entire childhood vaccination schedule as a whole. Studies comparing vaccinated and unvaccinated participants are often called VU studies. Reading from page 217, quote, and what about the establishment itself? By now you know that the medical establishment does not provide sufficient scientific evidence to support these safety claims, but you might be surprised to learn that government health agencies don't actually make those guarantees. If you search the websites of DHHS or the CDC for a statement claiming that the vaccination program of the United States has been tested for its effectiveness and safety, you will not find any. You may come across a webpage asserting that specific vaccines have been tested, individually or with other vaccines given on the same day, according to the recommended schedule, or that vaccine adverse events are well monitored. But you will not find a clear and explicit statement arguing that the vaccine program as a whole has been properly tested and found to be safe and effective. In case you were wondering, this is not a coincidence or indicative of negligence on the part of the CDC or DHHS. Of course, it is easy to believe that a government body might be slightly negligent in making important information accessible to the public through its website, but this is not the current case. A formal statement attesting to the scientific validity of the vaccine program as a whole does not appear on health authorities' websites because these institutions are well aware that it has never been tested. This fact was formally documented in the IOM 2013 report, which details many aspects of the vaccine program that have never been scientifically investigated. Firstly, the report acknowledges that no studies have ever compared the overall health of fully vaccinated children with that of children who have never been vaccinated. In addition, no VU studies have been conducted on specific health outcomes such as autism or autoimmune diseases. Furthermore, when a new vaccine is added to the vaccine schedule, no studies are done to examine its effects on other vaccines on the schedule. Research to evaluate different variations on the schedule to ensure it is still optimal is also never done, and bear in mind that each country implements its own vaccination schedule with different vaccine products, doses, and timings, etc., end quote. Page 240, quote, ask your doctor, are you familiar with any medical study that compared the overall health of vaccinated children with that of unvaccinated children? In the absence of studies comparing the overall health of vaccinated versus unvaccinated children, what is the scientific evidence for the safety and benefit of the vaccine program? In the absence of a study comparing the overall health of children who vaccinated according to the official vaccine schedule to that of children who received no vaccines, would you still tell parents their children are better off getting all routine vaccinations? If so, on what grounds? End quote. The IOM 2013 Report. After reading Chapter 6, I read the summary of the IOM 2013 report. It mentions that, quote, with the current schedule, children may receive up to 24 immunizations by age 2 years and up to 5 injections in a single visit, end quote. Some of the IOM 2013 summary's conclusions include, quote, conclusions about scientific findings. The committee encountered two major issues in its review of findings in the scientific literature. First, the concept of the immunization schedule is not well developed. Most vaccine-related research focuses on the outcomes of single immunizations or combinations of vaccines administered in a single visit, although each new vaccine is evaluated in the context of the overall immunization schedule that existed at the time of review of that vaccine. Elements of the schedule are not evaluated once it is adjusted to accommodate the new vaccine. Thus, key elements of the entire schedule, the number, frequency, timing, order, and age at administration of vaccines, have not been systematically examined in research studies. The second major issue that the committee encountered was uncertainty over whether the scientific literature has addressed all health outcomes and safety concerns. The committee could not tell whether its list was complete or whether a more comprehensive system of surveillance might have been able to identify other outcomes of potential significance to vaccine safety. In addition, the conditions of concern to some stakeholders, such as immunologic, neurologic, and developmental problems, are illnesses and conditions for which etiologies in general are not well understood. Finally, the committee found that evidence assessing outcomes in subpopulations of children who may be potentially susceptible to adverse reactions to vaccines, such as children with a family history of autoimmune disease or allergies, or children born prematurely, was limited and is characterized by uncertainty about the definition of populations of interest and definitions of exposure and outcomes. In summary, to consider whether and how to study the safety and health outcomes of the entire childhood immunization schedule, the field needs valid and accepted metrics of the entire schedule, the exposure, and clear definitions of health outcomes linked to stakeholder concerns, the outcomes, in rigorous research that will ensure validity and generalizability. End quote. To me, and my personal risk-benefit analysis matrix, these admissions contradict the committee's final conclusions, found on page 14 in their summary. Quote, concluding observations, the committee's efforts to identify priorities for recommended research studies did not reveal an evidence base suggesting that the childhood immunization schedule is linked to autoimmune diseases, asthma, hypersensitivity, seizures, childhood developmental disorders, learning disorders, or developmental disorders, or attention deficit or disruptive behavior disorders. The committee found no significant evidence to imply that the recommended immunization schedule is not safe. Furthermore, existing surveillance and response systems have identified known adverse events associated with vaccination. The federal research infrastructure is a strong system. End quote. Ignorance is strength. Moving to Chapter 7, Unsubstantiated Vaccination Guidelines, which was 26 pages with 31 references. And reading from page 246. Quote, it seems, therefore, that neither the WHO nor the CDC is aware of any timely and comprehensive safety assessment for the vaccine combinations currently recommended on the U.S. childhood vaccine schedule. The most comprehensive review they cite, possibly the only one in existence, was published more than 25 years ago and does not cover most of the vaccine combinations given today. More up-to-date information doesn't appear to be available. With no official record about the safety testing of current vaccine combinations to determine what testing has actually been done, one must scan the medical literature for each of the individual combinations in use and find the studies performed for each of the individual products. Let's consider, for example, the vaccines an American 15-month-old might receive according to the schedule. According to the CDC, at 15 months, a child could receive as many as 9 shots for 13 diseases. Different combinations of vaccine products exist for the applicable diseases, so the number of shots may vary between 5 and 9. A search of the medical literature failed to find any published report of a clinical trial or even a retrospective study which looked at the safety of concurrently administering this combination of vaccines. Vaccinating with this approved combination of shots effectively enrolls American infants into a large-scale vaccine trial without the parents' consent or awareness. Actually, using the term trial here is generous, as the results of this experiment are not tabulated and will never be published. End quote. So on page 261, quote, ask your doctor. Do you know of any studies that have examined the safety of the simultaneous administration of 9 vaccine injections against 13 different diseases to a 15-month-year-old infant? Are you familiar with any studies that have shown that spacing out vaccines does not reduce the number and severity of side effects? Do you believe that administering 10,000 vaccines in one day to an infant is safe? If you do, can you provide studies that have demonstrated the safety of this procedure? Do you know of any studies that examine the safety of the recommendation to vaccinate infants with mild illness? If not, what is the scientific evidence on which the CDC relies in determining that this would not increase the risk for vaccine injury? End quote. Part 2, Founding Myths. Chapter 8, The Disappearance of Disease. 40 pages with 125 references. I enjoy this chapter as well, as it shed light on some interesting aspects of the history of sanitation, hygiene, etc. Page 284, quote, following the publication of McCowan's research, the academic consensus holds that the major contributors to the decline were improvements in sanitation and hygiene, a rise in the standard of living, better nutrition, and the gradual introduction of medical interventions during the 20th century, end quote. Page 287. Quote, life was harsh for urban horses, and average life expectancy was as low as 4 years. Thus, it was common in 19th century cities for horses to collapse and die on the street. New York City, for example, cleared some 15,000 horse carcasses from the city's streets in the year 1880 alone, end quote. And page 299, quote, the disparity between the societal burden of chronic and infectious disease morbidity has only grown wider from 1979 to the present. Infectious disease morbidity in children, which was already relatively low, continued to slowly decline. At the same time, the proportion of chronically ill and disabled children, which was already very high in 1979, 3.9%, more than doubled by 2010 to 8%. In addition, it should be noted that for every disabled child in 2010, there were two others who routinely took medication for their chronic conditions. These numbers are considerably higher than, for example, the rate of children hospitalized due to an infectious disease during the same period, an average rate of about 1% in ages 0 to 19, end quote. And jumping to Chapter 9 on herd immunity, which was 62 pages with 253 references. The end of Chapter 9 generously summarizes their 50-page analysis with hundreds of references and rabbit holes to explore. Page 358, quote, routine vaccines and herd immunity, a summary. Table 9.1 below presents the vaccines of the U.S. childhood routine schedule and summarizes the relevant information regarding herd immunity for each. Of the 14 vaccines, only 5, one-third, can be said to definitely provide relevant herd protection for children, as is detailed below. Table 9.1, Herd Immunity of Vaccines of the U.S. Routine Schedule. And this table goes through each vaccine or disease and describes its herd immunity science and then describes the disease in terms of its pre-vaccine incidence and the disease's severity. So the first row in this table is tetanus, which they say does not confer herd immunity. Their description says, the bacterium lives in animal feces and soil. The vaccine targets the toxin rather than the bacterium, and therefore cannot prevent transmission. They say the pre-vaccine incidence was very rare, but the severity was lethal. The next row is inactivated polio, SALK. They summarize that the vaccine does not prevent replication of the virus in the gut and its excretion in the feces. So it does not confer herd immunity. They say the pre-vaccine incidence was low, but the severity was severe. Next is pertussis, which they say does not have confer herd immunity. They summarize that the current acellular vaccine does not prevent infection with the bacterium or transmission to others. And they say the pre-vaccine incidence was high and the severity was medium. Next is diphtheria, which they say does not confer herd immunity. The vaccine works against the toxin, not the bacterium, and therefore does not prevent infection and transmission. There's no solid evidence for herd protection. And the pre-vaccine incidence was high, and the severity was severe. Influenza, they say, does not confer herd immunity. They summarize, vaccine efficacy is moderate to low. The virus is constantly evolving. Therefore, a new vaccine must be formulated every year targeting the strains that are expected to be common in the coming winter season. The pre-vaccine incidence is high, and the severity is medium to high. Hepatitis A did not confer herd immunity. They summarize, the disease is very mild in children, and infection with the virus provides lifelong immunity. Children receive no benefit from the herd protection provided by the vaccine. Pre-vaccine incidence low, severity very mild in children, moderate in adults. Hep B, no herd immunity. The vaccine is redundant for about 99% of children. The herd protection it provides is relevant only to children living with a chronic carrier of the disease. The pre-vaccine incidence, low. Severity, moderate. Next is rotavirus, no herd immunity. They summarize that the disease itself does not fully prevent future infection or morbidity. There is some evidence for the existence of a herd protection effect for the vaccine, but the body of research on the subject is preliminary and definitive conclusions cannot be drawn. The pre-vaccine incidence was very high, with severity of mild to moderate. Next on table 9-1 is pneumococcal, which is a gray area in terms of herd immunity. They rate it. They summarize, the vaccine provides partial herd protection only against the serotypes it contains. It does not reduce the rate of bacterial carriers in the population due to the phenomenon of serotype replacement. They say pre-vaccine incidence was low and severity was moderate. And HIV, they say it does confer herd immunity. They summarize, there is epidemiological and biological evidence of vaccine-induced herd immunity. The pre-vaccine incidence was low, and severity is moderate. Next in the table is varicella, chickenpox. They say it does provide herd immunity. Summarizing, the vaccine appears to provide herd protection, but it is not routinely given in some industrialized countries. The pre-vaccine incidence, very high, and the severity, mild. Next is rubella. They say does confer herd immunity, summarizing that the vaccine appears to have nearly extinguished the spread of the virus in the population. The pre-vaccine incidence, low, and the severity, very mild in children, serious in fetuses. Next is mumps, which they say does confer herd immunity, summarizing that the vaccine almost completely eliminated morbidity despite sporadic outbreaks in adults reported from time to time. The pre-vaccine incidence was high and the severity is mild. And the last row on table 9-1 is measles, which they say does confer herd immunity. They summarize that the vaccine almost completely eliminated the disease, with a pre-vaccine incidence of very high and a severity of mild. Next is Chapter 10, The Mysteries of Polio. This was 128 pages with 447 references. This monster of a chapter dives deep into the history of polio science. Most of this was new to me, but I thought the authors made compelling arguments pointing to very weak foundations. On page 426, quote, although the amount of spray residue left on fruit marketed to American consumers steadily increased from the end of the 19th century onwards, federal authorities made no effort in the early 20th century to control or limit the amount of arsenic or lead in agricultural produce. It was only in the 1920s that the Bureau of Chemistry at the U.S. Department of Agriculture began testing arsenic levels in fruit and vegetable shipments. Unfortunately, the inherent conflict of interest between the Bureau of Chemistry's role overseeing the use of pesticides in agriculture and its department's stated mission, promoting agriculture, limited the Bureau's actions and hampered its ability to enforce its own recommendations. Attempts to impose maximum thresholds for lead and arsenic content in fruit met, as expected, with fierce opposition from farmer organizations and elected officials who acted on their behalf. Hopping down to page 428, quote, "By the time the veil concealing the dangers of toxic pesticides was lifted in the 1930s, and papers demonstrating pesticides' harms began appearing in medical journals, the virus theory of polio was already well established. Thus, the odds that a scientist or a doctor would look for or recognize a link between lead arsenate and paralytic polio was quite slim. A polio researcher who went against the established dogma was liable to be sharply criticized by his peers for and ignored by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which in those days sponsored virtually all polio research. Moreover, this hypothetical maverick researcher would likely have been the object of brutal attacks by the agricultural lobby and the big pesticide-producing chemical companies," end quote. Page 474, quote, "After 4 years of meticulous research, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962, publicly exposing the harmful environmental effects of DDT for the first time. Carson's book raised awareness of DDT's impact on wildlife instantaneously, initiating public debate and a legacy of environmental activism that lasts to this day. While the destructive effects of DDT were new to the public, government authorities, however, had no need for such an introduction. They had been aware of the compound's dangers for years, and, as we shall soon see, had already taken steps to monitor and even reduce its use. As early as 1946, Dr. Fred Bishop from the Bureau of Entomology of the U.S. Department of Agriculture was writing about the toxicity of DDT to the nervous system. In a paper published in the American Journal of Public Health, Bishop warns that DDT must not be allowed to get into foods, and care must be taken when spraying it on crops intended for human or animal consumption," end quote. Born near the start of the 80s, I barely remember the environmental movement before it was co-opted by climate change alarmism based on computer models and non-falsifiable hypotheses. Since the early 2010s, I have concluded that it would be far more help to our environment if we focused on all the man-made novel pollutants, which are intended or known to harm life, instead of carbon, which sustains life. Back to the Turtles book on page 482, quote, "Over time, more and more cases of non-polio flaccid paralysis were identified and placed under a newly formed umbrella of acute flaccid paralysis, AFP, syndrome. While reported polio morbidity dropped to almost zero between 1988 and 2010, the global incidence of AFP has risen to about 100,000 cases in 2010, three times the global level of paralytic illness recorded in 1988, end quote. And now we'll jump to Chapter 10 summary starting on page 486, quote, 19 polio mysteries. The list below summarizes the polio mysteries discussed in this chapter. For each, we present explanations, if any, according to both the officially sanctioned history of polio and the pesticides theory. 1. Why did polio epidemics emerge in the United States, specifically in the late 19th century? Institutional. Due to better hygiene, first exposure to the polio virus occurred later in life, often when people no longer had protective maternal antibodies. This is the improved hygiene theory, which, as the chapter shows, is inconsistent with the biological evidence and flatly contradicts most of the epidemiological evidence as well. And for the pesticides theory on mystery number 1, pesticides, particularly lead arsenate, began to be widely used in the U.S. in the late 19th century. 2. Why did polio epidemics strike industrialized countries in the first half of the 20th century, when almost none occurred in the developing world? Institutional theory. According to this senseless, improved hygiene theory, in the third world, sanitation and hygiene remained poor, so polio incidence also remained very low. For the pesticides theory, before World War II, pesticides were rarely used by indigenous people in developing countries. 3. Why did polio hit hardest in the summer and early autumn? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, in the northern hemisphere, the majority of sprayed fruits and vegetables were picked and consumed in the summer and autumn months. Mystery number 4. Why did polio's incidence peak in the summer when most children are not attending school, even though the disease's purported mode of transition, person to person, favors crowded conditions? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, person-to-person transmission is largely irrelevant for pesticide-induced morbidity. Mystery number 5. Why did most of the early polio outbreaks occur in sparsely populated rural areas rather than in large and crowded metropolitan areas? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, farming communities were the first to be poisoned by the use of toxic pesticides. Mystery number 6. Why were many of the early polio outbreaks in rural areas accompanied by concurrent outbreaks of paralysis in domestic animals? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, farm animals and pets, like humans, were also exposed to pesticides in their food and environment. Mystery number 7. Why did polio emerge and intensify during a historic period when mortality and morbidity of most infectious diseases were dramatically declining? Institutional theory, polio emerged due to better sanitation and hygiene, while other diseases declined for the same reason. For the pesticides theory, paralysis epidemics weren't caused by an infectious agent, but rather by pesticide intoxication. Pesticide use increased during this period. Mystery 8. Why were high polio rates observed in European residents of developing countries, while local residents rarely experienced acute flaccid paralysis? Institutional theory, according to the improved hygiene theory, Europeans were not exposed to the polio virus as infants and got sick when first exposed to the virus, which was ubiquitous in developing countries, at an older age. The pesticides theory, European residents in developing countries were protecting themselves from local insects with pesticides that the locals didn't use. Mystery 9. Why was polio incidence much higher in Western soldiers stationed in different parts of the world during and after World War II than in their comrades back home? Institutional theory. According to the senseless improved hygiene theory, these soldiers were more exposed to polio virus in foreign countries than their peers at home. The pesticides theory. The overseas military environment was heavily sprayed with pesticides to fight disease-carrying insects. Mystery 10. Why was polio incidence among World War II British officers in India, North Africa, and Italy 5 to 10 times higher than that of British enlisted men? Institutional, no explanation. Pesticides, officers' barracks, clubs, etc. were presumably sprayed more extensively to protect the officers even more than enlisted men. Mystery number 11. Why were polio's disease patterns, for example, the age distribution of patients being similar in epidemic and low prevalence years, so different for those typical of other childhood infectious diseases? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, epidemics were dependent on various factors related to pesticides use. Mystery 12. Why did polio incidence suddenly skyrocket in many industrialized nations after World War II? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, many countries which had not used pesticides much prior to World War II began using DDT extensively in the post-war years due to its safety, reputation, low price, and high efficacy. Mystery 13. Why did polio epidemics in post-World War II United States begin occurring in consecutive years rather than once every few years as in the pre-war period? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, DDT use in the post-war years far exceeded that of the pesticides in the pre-war years. Mystery 14. Why, contrary to other infectious diseases, are polio patients virtually non-contagious, while the disease is presumably spread so easily by healthy people? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, morbidity wasn't due to an infectious agent. So these questions are irrelevant. Mystery 15, why do several members of the same household tend to contract polio at the same time rather than one after the other, as usually happens with infectious diseases? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, morbidity wasn't due to an infectious agent. Several members of the house of a household could easily be simultaneously exposed to toxic compounds from food and other sources, such as spraying devices in the home. Mystery 16. How did the Salk vaccine manage to nearly eradicate polio in the U.S. and other countries, even though at least 20% of the paralysis was not caused by the polio virus? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, polio-like morbidity was mainly caused by exposure to pesticides. The drop in morbidity started before the Salk vaccine and continued in all segments of the population, regardless of the vaccine. Mystery 17. How did the Salk vaccine manage to completely eliminate the spread of the polio virus in countries where it was given exclusively, even though the vaccine essentially does not confer herd immunity? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, same as above. Mystery 18. Why didn't polio epidemics appear in the developing world until the second half of the 20th century? Institutional theory. Polio thrives in conditions of poor sanitation and hygiene that are prevalent in the developing world. Never mind the fact that this contradicts both the improved hygiene theory and the epidemiological evidence from the earliest polio outbreaks. The pesticides theory says, after World War II, the use of pesticides in developing countries expanded rapidly, especially DDT and lead and arsenic-based compounds. Finally, polio mystery 19. Why is polio in the developing world associated with a poor standard of living, while in the West it was linked to the opposite? Institutional theory, no explanation. Pesticides theory, polio-like paralysis is mainly caused by pesticide use and has little to do with standards of living, in the broad sense. End quote. And on page 494, quote, the foundations of polio science are so inadequate and sketchy, despite more than 100 years of intensive research effort, that it's small wonder it does not provide convincing solutions to most of the mysteries and question marks surrounding the disease since it became a public health threat in the late 19th century. End quote. I never would have guessed the history of polio science that this book presents, and I look forward to learning more about this subtopic in the future. And finally, chapter 11, The Vaccine Hoax, 21 pages, zero references. And the final chapter provides a succinct summary of each previous chapter, followed by a discussion of the information wars. Page 514, quote, the last person to attempt injecting some vaccine truth was talk show host Katie Couric, who in 2013 interviewed a mother whose daughter died shortly after receiving the HPV vaccine, Gardasil. Following the airing of the show, Couric was immediately attacked by every major news outlet for, in her own words, spending too much time on the serious adverse events that had been reported in very rare cases following the vaccine. She was quick to issue a public apology, thus presumably paying the price for her dire mistake and saving her career. To date, no one in mainstream media has dared to follow her footsteps, end quote. And now page 516, quote, a 21st century debate conducted on an internet-based platform such as Facebook would be the perfect setting to allow a comprehensive, thorough, and productive debate. The two sides could lay down their arguments meticulously, providing references and supporting material as required. The debate could go on for days or even weeks, elucidating relevant topics as the need arose. The audience could follow at their leisure, weigh the arguments made by both sides, check the references, and make up their own minds. If one side played unfairly, evading questions, refusing to back up their arguments, etc., this would be noted by the viewers and reflected in their success. Such a debate would be the perfect mechanism for settling many of the controversies surrounding vaccination. And that is exactly why the medical establishment's spokespersons will never engage in such a debate, wherein substance would speak louder than sound bites. Just imagine a debate where the vaccine experts are publicly asked the inconvenient questions this book has presented. They would have no choice but to evade direct replies, as they have no adequate answers. Within days, this debate could be viewed by millions all over the globe, spelling a PR mega-disaster for the vaccine establishment. End quote. And the book's concluding thoughts resonate deeply with me. They echo logic and philosophies that I have also tried to promote over the years. On last page, 518, quote, "Science is ever-evolving, and free scientific discussion guarantees its progress. True scientists are not afraid of discussion. They are eager for it. A one-sided scientific discussion is a feature of dark historical periods and totalitarian regimes, not free democratic societies. Science belongs to the people. It belongs to humanity, not to corrupt government agencies and pharmaceutical giants who collude to rewrite the principles of science in order to continue the decades-long cover-up of their crimes against humanity. The magnitude of these crimes is enormous. These entities are in way too deep to ever be able to admit any wrongdoing. They will do whatever is necessary to protect the great vaccine hoax. For them, it is a matter of life and death, literally. And so it is for us." End quote. My conclusions. This book presents dozens of critical questions which it alleges still demand answers. It is definitely worth reading and considering. These questions warrant further investigation, transparent data, and nuanced communication from health authorities. I made some efforts to try to find attempts to debunk or refute the key claims made in this book. I found a few articles and discussed them above, but they did not seem to directly address or refute key claims. The vaccine evangelists' rebuttals were almost always addressed or refuted within the book. Most of all, it seems that critics of this book simply agree with the current ethical paradigm for vaccine trials. This paradigm is endorsed by the health authorities intertwined with the pharmaceutical industry. During the 2009 swine flu pandemic, I was skeptical or terrified of the vaccine which was quickly released for such a novel and deadly virus. This episode is when I got interested in the biosecurity state and medical martial law. I was also listening more seriously to parents and doctors who were trying to sound the alarm on childhood vaccine schedules. I was very opposed to almost all fear-mongering and public policy reactions to the COVID-19 pandemic from its start in early 2020. Millions of us were asking critical questions throughout the pandemic. Scientists investigating COVID's infection fatality rate, IFR, published that, quote, "the median IFR was 0.0003% at 0 to 19 years old," end quote. The idea of vaccinating children with the new experimental COVID injections never passed any kind of risk-benefit analysis. Published in the British Medical Journal in 2021, quote, "on paper, the Phase 3 studies by Pfizer, Moderna, and Janssen are all of 2 years' duration. But after collecting only 6 months of data on efficacy and safety, these received emergency use authorization, EUA. And within weeks of the vaccines receiving an EUA, the unblinding of the trials commenced as placebo recipients were offered the chance to get vaccinated." End quote. Operation Warp Speed was brought to you by Donald Trump, Moncef Salawi, Anthony Fauci, and an army of others. They never included tests for the shot's effects on virus transmission. Between the low IFR estimates, the lack of long-term clinical safety data, and no claims of significant reduction in transmission, I do not think it was ever ethical to give COVID injections to children at all. Any doctor or health authority that recommended experimental COVID injections for children completely lost my trust, at least regarding some issues. The CDC's vaccine schedule recommends children receive COVID-19 gene therapy shots starting at 6 months old. Since the clinical trials were unblinded, that's the same age as the safety data they rely upon. Over the past 4 years, countless millions of Americans are finally exploring related rabbit holes of alternative data. The skeptics got more organized in the face of public policy emergencies. These policies violate basic liberties and, to varying degrees, bodily autonomy. My strong opposition to the COVID shots has long felt very informed, but I now have a baby and needed to know more about childhood vaccines. So this book, Turtles All the Way Down, Vaccine Science and Myth, has been very helpful in working through the various subtopics and debates. It identifies important dividing lines between various narratives and bodies of evidence. I look forward to finding or hearing some more answers to some of the critical questions posed here. If a fraction of this book's conclusions are factually accurate, then we face a bleak situation, and the tide is still turning very slowly. I also recently read another book, Vaxxed Unvaxxed, Let the Science Speak, by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Brian Hooker, Ph.D., from 2023. It concludes with 6 constructive ideas, which the book describes in more detail. So I will leave you with these proposed solutions, which may be able to transcend partisan politics and politicized sciences. As you build your own risk analyses and conclusions, be sure to search out a variety of informed viewpoints and encourage open debate. I wish you luck diving into these topics, as they are tough, but critical. And wish me luck, too. Reading from Vaxxed Unvaxxed, page 184. Quote, "The Vaccine Safety Project of Children's Health Defense, CHD, is an outcome of an investigative review of the U.S. government's vaccine approval recommendations process and post-marketing safety monitoring. CHD and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. formulated these 6 steps as necessary recommendations for improving vaccine safety and protecting children from vaccine injuries. 6 steps to vaccine safety. 1. Subject vaccines to the same rigorous approval process as other drugs. 2. Mandatory reporting of vaccine adverse events and automate the VAERS and VSD databases. 3. Ensure everyone involved with federal vaccine approvals and recommendations are free from conflicts of interest. 4. Reevaluate all vaccines recommended by the ACIP prior to the adoption of evidence-based guidelines. 5. Study what makes some individuals more susceptible to vaccine injury. And 6. Support fully informed consent and individual rights to refuse vaccination." And the acronyms in those steps were VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, VSD is the Vaccine Safety Data Link, and ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, end quote. Feedback, comments, and answers to this post questions are welcomed via WikiWorld Order's Minds profile. Thanks so much for listening, and take care till next time.